I felt like what I'm experiencing right now is like impossible to bottle. It's this very unique experience of facing mortality. And I think cancer, or certain illnesses in particular, where you have this slow walk up to your end zone, it's like you're really in this conversation with mortality in a way that's different than being, you know, hit by a bus, as they say, or some sudden bam thing.
Hey there, friend. Welcome to Happy Debt. My name is Emily Veach, and today I want to talk about getting hit by a bus. You've probably heard this expression or even used it before. Most people mean it in a sort of carpe diem kind of way. The thinking is that because you never know what's coming, you shouldn't get bogged down in the what-ifs and the fears of some potential imminent disaster lurking just out of sight. Instead, you should stop thinking about those scary possibilities and focus on the positives. Dwelling on the unknowns will keep you from enjoying what you have. And if that bus does manage to sneak up on you and you die all of a sudden, then you will have wasted your time worrying because it would all be over anyway. I don't mean to be gruesome here, but this idea of getting hit by a bus keeps coming up in conversations that I have with my cancer friends. Most of us have scans several times a year where we find out if treatment is still working. It can be scary to keep facing that unknown repeatedly. Our guest today, my friend, Lita Dieterich, even uses the term medical PTSD. But the best way I've found to keep moving forward is not to look away from the unknown, but to confront it. In my mind, a cancer diagnosis feels like getting hit by a bus and surviving. All of a sudden, bam, you're forced to face your own mortality. Life as you've known it is different, and you have to pick up the pieces, figure out a way forward, and keep putting one foot in front of the other. Lita was a great writer, a fantastic mother, and a passionate advocate. We met through my Bay Area support group, and we hit it off right away. As we hiked up a steep fire road in the Berkeley Hills one day, the conversation naturally turned to life and mortality, and Lita got really excited when I invited her to be on this podcast. And I'm so grateful that we found the time. About 18 months after we recorded this interview, Lita's family shared the news that her body had died. And I think that working on this through grief has been as challenging as it's been healing. And I think that kind of explains why it can take me such a long time to finish an episode. So, thanks for understanding. Thanks for being here. Here's Lita talking about identity and how her goals and perspectives have changed in the time since her diagnosis. I'll be back after the interview to talk with you a little bit more.
You know, what I would say is that before my cancer diagnosis, like all people, especially in our culture, you know, you're kind of encouraged on a regular basis to have your sort of Twitter bio, right? Like, what are the 10 words that describe you? And I remember early on in Facebook when that whole thing went around that was like, the 25 things you can do, the 25 things that no one knows about you. And it was like this big narcissistic chain letter, you know? And that's sort of like a lot of what is in, I think a lot of what is encouraged and emphasized in our culture. So I really, and I think in the early parts of my diagnosis, the the shedding of that, both willing and unwilling, was part of the process.
Like, yeah, it kind of gets ripped away
from you. It gets ripped away a bit, right? You get kind of stripped, and then you have to assimilate. Like, I used to think I was this. Well, no, I'm not. You know, I had this. I was the REI mom, you know, the mom that, like, that was like, let my kids paint themselves blue in the, on the kitchen table, and then, like, didn't care if it took 5 hours to clean up, you know? Or, like, I was always the one up for, like, we're going to go for that five-hour hike, or we're... And having to learn how to manage a different energy body, and then the questions of purpose, because I was strongly a person who thought, like, my agreement with the gods was I was here to, like, help and be of service and, like, make big things happen for people who needed it. And then just realizing, oh, wow, I can't really do that. Like, my goal right now is to survive and to give my kids as normal of a life as possible for as long as possible. Mm. And that seems, and nothing else matters anymore. And I think that at this point, 3 years out, that has been fully integrated. So I'm not, when you ask me, who are you? I don't, or what, when you ask me, how would I describe you? I don't kind of go into a panicked identity crisis anymore. I'm just like, I don't really have an idea. Like, I'm here, I'm a mom, I'm trying to survive. That's kind of who I am.
I feel like it's perfect. And I, I feel very similar just because you're forced, or I feel like I've been forced to assimilate, like you said, to adapt and be present, as hokey as it sounds, because it's all you've really got. I mean, it's really hard for me to describe these ideas that you're actually putting very eloquently about identity and purpose and finding meaning in life. You know,
this is what I've really learned in the past 3 years. Like, people have been, you know, there was, like, a whole world of people struggling with illness that I never knew. I never knew that until I was really in it, because I just have been very lucky to not have been surrounded by that in my own family for most of my life, or with my children, or I've been lucky to be surrounded by a lot of health. So, and now it's like, oh, wow, like, that's been happening the whole time. Like, life and death, we're walking side by side all the time.
It's so humbling.
Yeah.
To realize just how bad some people have life in general for so many years. I feel like I had a few decades plus of really healthy, strong, active, able to do anything. But I also feel like in the past few years, having terminal cancer, like, it wakes you up.
Yeah.
And I think I appreciate things differently. I don't know about more, because I couldn't have appreciated them the same way that I do now.
Right, you wouldn't have been able to see.
Yeah.
I think there is, I was very aware of this actually very early in my diagnosis, when we had no idea what would happen, and I felt like what I'm experiencing right now is, like, impossible to bottle. It's this very unique experience of facing mortality. And I think cancer, or certain illnesses in particular, where you have this slow walk up to your end zone, it's like you're really in this conversation with mortality in a way that's different than being, you know, hit by a bus, as they say, or some sudden bam thing.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's like it's not so shocking, so you can't really find anything to be angry about. It's like a slow drip.
It's a slow drip. Yeah. I've had moments of thinking about using the term slow boil, but I don't like that actually, because it doesn't feel totally true, even though parts of it feel like that.
Yeah.
I like slow drip. I'm going to take that.
Please.
I'm going to take that. That's so much better, because I do think that it's a, things get stripped away and then you assimilate and integrate. And I did have a big insight about 2 months ago that sort of shocked me, because I was trying to figure out, like, what would I have done if I hadn't had cancer? Like, what would my life have been like if things had gone the way they were going, you know? And that's a whole other conversation that I could have. But what I realized is that through this process of the last 3 years, that there was a way in which my heart had got stronger and fuller and was made more, has been made more whole. And whatever like fissures were still there were really healed, even as my body was struggling. And that was kind of a shocking insight to me. Like, oh, wow, that, right, there is, there actually are so many gifts in this wound that I wish I could have that. I joke sometimes, like, couldn't we have just had the, like, transformational cancer experience where you, like, clarify all your values, like, and then you're done. You know, like, I've survived. But that's not our path, right?
Yeah. And then you have the added dimension of, you know, we were both diagnosed 3 years ago,
right,
more or less. And now you are in a very different situation than me. I mean, we're both in this regular scan. I have scans every 3 months. And you never know if it's going to be changed, shake up. But I've never had another progression since my first one. You've so much.
Yeah, it's been a hard
change. Very difficult change, very scary change. And I don't know what that's like. I mean, I see and I can kind of get a sense of it from my friends who are in, you know, a different trajectory from me. But
yeah,
I guess my question is, what's that like, friend?
What's that like?
Do you get used to it?
You know, I do remember a friend saying to me after my very first progression, and then I think I went into a scan right after that and I was really nervous, and she said it gets easier with time. And I think that that's true. I do think you just assimilate, you know, you, and I've learned, I've also done some work and I've worked with a therapist, particularly on medical PTSD. Like, how can I live my life so that when I look at that email coming in from my healthcare provider, I don't, you know, go into a panic mode. So we did that and that was very helpful. But I think the thing of like, right, you are at this point not in a life-threatening situation. I am, because my liver is necessary for me to survive and it's threatened right now. I don't quite know.
Are you able to let go of that? I'm putting words in your mouth, but let go of the fear?
I am mostly not in fear. I'm not sure how that happens, honestly. I do not know how that works. I consider that luck. Is that the luck of my neuroscience? Is that the luck of being a mother, which is the hardest part of having cancer in one way, but it also is completely present making, right? Like, you just can't get into your own head for very long because you have these little people that need you, and and the joy of being in that day-to-day experience with them is the best medicine of all. So I mostly am not terrified.
You've also done a lot of work. You mentioned working on the effects of medical PTSD with therapists.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot that both of us do to give ourselves the best chances mentally, physically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really good thing to talk about, actually, because I think, you know, in my prior life, I might have been a little bit, I might have felt like seeing a therapist or taking anti-anxiety meds, for example, or any of those things, I would feel a little shame from that. Like, that meant I couldn't, like, do it myself. And I don't feel that way anymore. So when I was first diagnosed with breast cancer, someone actually was like, basically, my surgeon, who's the first line in breast cancer, which is so weird, but it just is that way, as you know, like, it basically handed me a bottle of Ativan. Like, you need this. Just do it for now. Because there was so much to assimilate. And I, you know, especially having young kids where I didn't really have the option to just collapse on a regular basis. And I have actually learned to kind of work with that throughout. And so in moments when, like, I come, when I do feel like it's, I'm getting kind of looped out, I have, you know, I take an Ativan and it really helps. I don't take it every day. I haven't felt that I needed that, but it's been, that's like one of my tools. I guess I have a tool, tools for the fear thing, but I also think I'm just wired, like, not to focus on it somehow. Because I don't want to spend whatever days I have left terrified. I want to be here. I'm not particularly afraid of dying myself. I had one moment where I was like, what if I came back? What if reincarnation is true and I came back and, like, some... And I was just imprisoned in solitary confinement for 50 years. You know, I had, like, wow. I was looping, you know. But that didn't last long. That was, like, my existential dread moment. That was a couple years ago. But I think you know, what I suspect is true for many women like me who still have school-age children is that that's just, there's a quality of vulnerability that's... you know, that'll take you down. That'll take you down, you know? And so I have to just, but in the talking about death, which I think is so healthy for all of us to be, like, leaning in on, which again, I would say in the cultural context, it's something we're very afraid of for whatever reason here. I have to trust, I've learned to trust that my children have a path that isn't about me. And so even if my possible early death would impact them, because of course it would, it doesn't necessarily need to be what defines them, you know? But that's the hardest part for sure. That is, I mean...
That makes sense.
That's the hardest part. Yeah. And I think when I... But it's funny, like, we went to Stanford the other day. I looked at my CT scan. That's always hard. To just see, you're like, how does that... wow. Okay, that looks
bad. It's hard to actually see the scan itself.
Yeah. You know, see my liver. Mm-hmm. See what my liver looks like on a CT scan.
What do you feel in those moments?
I wonder if I'm deluding myself into thinking that I can get through it. Because there's a part of me that is active most of the time that thinks I'm going to live a long time. That's just... And I'm not like a denialist at all. Anybody who knows me would know that. I've walked up. I'm not a denialist. But it's like that's just what feels real in my body. Is that just the body, like the human body, doesn't... you know, wants to survive. Like, I'm a mammal.
Right.
Like, is that just mammalian instinct? That's like, of course you're going to survive.
Well, if you convince yourself that you're not, I mean, it'd be really hard to go through any other part of your day. You know, I think it's just the way that we're wired.
Wired to survive.
Yeah.
But when I look at those images, I see how the doctors talk to me, and, you know, no one talks about prognosis, and I don't ask because I don't want to know. And the ones who are honest will say none of us know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now in this, there's no me, and there's no even data on me and women like me at this point. There's so few, we're such a small cohort, you know, women with extensive liver mets.
Yeah, I think there's something about having to confront that reality right in the face and the unknown of what happens next. Because we're, like you said, there's not data. Even on people like me who only have bone mets, we're still in experimentation mode.
Totally.
And that's why we keep scanning every 3 months, because we never know what's going to change it.
Right.
So, but I think, you know, to what you were saying about seeing the actual CT scans, it's just a really powerful moment where you have to remind yourself, maybe, that we don't know what this means.
Right, and that this is happening in my body. And and then, you know, when the doctors start to talk about these palliative measures, right, where, you know, and I can tell, like, oh, they think they're going to just give me, like, a year here. I mean, they're not giving me numbers, but this particular treatment could, you know, you read the statistics, it's like, oh, progression-free survival was, you know, 3.3 months in this group and 4.5 months in this group. And I'm like, wow. I remember the first time I read that. That was pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
You know. So, I don't know. But in terms of like, okay, this podcast is called Happy Death. And I am also fascinated with just like the quantum realm, my ancestors, like what is happening around me? Like, this is such a complex universe that we're in. And
have you always felt that way? Like curiosity?
Yeah. I've always had like a deep spiritual curiosity, and I've never really been afraid of death. I've always kind of assumed it was probably okay. I think my biggest concerns about death have been, well, you know, before having children, it was my mother, because her mother died when she was young. And I felt like I made this commitment that I wouldn't sandwich her. And, you know, between the mother that dies young and the daughter that dies young, like that just feels really screwed up. And it is one of the big heartaches of this. Like, it's, I just feel like my mother deserves way better than this. That was my first thing. Like, I don't really care about dying, but like, I don't want to have this impact my mom in this way. Which, of course, is also true for my dad. Both my parents are living because I'm lucky and they were healthy most of my life. and just seeing, you know, we talk about it, but I also think they're trying so hard to not have it be about them, because they're both who they are and they're very emotionally courageous people. But I just know, like, oh, yeah. That takes parents down, this kind of thing. And then with the kids, you know, but for my own self, I sort of have this idea that death is probably pretty fun. That's sort of my idea about it, you know. I believe that. Like, I believe that there's something, there's a real, you know, I'm not a real Buddhist. I think I have Buddhist leanings. Buddhist tendencies. But this whole like, concept of samsara and like we're just here all suffering together, you know, that I do think being embodied is very hard.
Yeah. Well, I also think that before diagnosis, when I look back at myself now before diagnosis, I see that I was still a person suffering, like you know, just mentioned. But there's so many things to distract you, and you still like feel pretty good. Like there's no imminent thing that's there, you know, affecting you. But it's just once that changes, you're just reminded of it so much more often.
Yeah. I think there's also the thing that I'm really struck by, and I had to let go of this. This is one of the strip, grief, assimilate thing. That's what I call the process, you know, loss, grief, assimilation. I feel like that's a cycle that we're all going through over and over again. It just keeps happening. was that, you know, I couldn't, the choices, because I was also like you, I think you and I are similar this way. I actually took really good care of my body. I loved to exercise. I was really interested in food and nutrition. I had literally before, in November of 2016, which was a couple months before my diagnosis, which was de novo metastatic to the liver, I had done this big liver cleanse, which was sort of like, I just finished breastfeeding. I'm going to like get back into my body. We're going to start caring. So this loss of these sort of small choices that you can make to improve your life and improve your health, or that you can just make choices like, oh, I'm just going to not, you know, I won't eat gluten and dairy and see what that's like, or I'll experiment with intermittent fasting or any other number of health fads that are out there. That's just like not optional anymore, right? Like maybe those things can tweak around the edges. We can decide, but like, that's just not, like those choices to make change. I think people don't recognize the privilege of that. Like the choice that you have to make change, because you and I don't really have a lot of control, right?
Yeah.
We have a teensy weensy bit of control for managing side effects.
Right. Let's talk about control, because that is a topic that I think about a lot and that has given me a lot of perspective as I've come to adapt to this life. And just, I think at first especially, the loss of control, the feeling like I was this insignificant blip in the medical institution. Like, I can do all these healthy things and still get bad news. You know, it's like, how do you, or how have you adapted to that loss of control? Has it been, it changed over time? Does it still bother you?
You know, I think it's also this process, right? Because in the beginning, I think I was grasping onto whatever control I had. Mm. You know, like what is the frame here that's clear that I can kind of feel myself inside? And like, and so I could make some choices in that way. And like, I really, really ramped up the physical exercise the first couple of years of my diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I was doing it pretty like for the Mets, you know, my big explosion this year, I was doing boot camps and strength training and mm-hmm. feeling strong. And I felt like I could really work with the, I had some control over managing side effects. And I was just like, I'm going to try to stay as healthy as possible, you know. I think this year has been a real, because, you know, in May of this year, out of nowhere, my liver mets just exploded. And I say that just for benefit of people who don't already know, as you know. I think, and then I've been on, you know, 6 different treatments in 10 months. So every time I would start to get control, I would kind of get slammed back. I have that image of like, you know, you start to run, and then you just get slammed back, you know. So then I think I realized, oh, there's no rhythm. There is no control there. I have to actually let go completely. And even
let go of an expectation,
trying to kind of stay on top of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, trying to stand on top of it and like find a rhythm, find a clear, steady rhythm, which I think, like, as humans, we want that.
For life in general, you mean?
Yeah, I think we all kind of want that, right? So you get a treatment. And I think people who even are struggling with less serious illness relate to this. If you're all of a sudden needing to take medicine for your heart or diabetes or something, medicine that's has some side effects, and you have to kind of learn how to work with it and roll with it. But, you know, for many people, that's like they go through that adjustment and then it lasts them for 25 years.
Right.
So not for
like
me,
your case where you were maybe adjusting for a little while and then thinking that that's going to be kind of whatever you're going to, whatever you're feeling like is what will stick. And then it changes again in an unexpected way.
It keeps changing. You know, I do think that from the very, from the beginning of my diagnosis, I have felt like really what this whole experience is about is the balance between surrender and control. What do I have to really just let go of, and what can I control? I mean, I, like you, I mean, I feel in some ways it's a privilege in my situation that I have a good education, that I understand medical literature, and
it's huge.
I understand research. It's insanely huge. But I won't say not afraid, because it is terribly uncomfortable to be pushing and advocating the way that I have. It is not easy for me.
Right.
But I can do it.
Right.
But I still do it.
To go back, it's surrender, control, and advocate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can surrender entirely, and that means you just fall off the map.
Yeah. So I haven't done that.
You know, and something we were talking about earlier is just how hard it is and how much work and how much work it is to push for the care that you think you need or that you don't even know that you might need.
Yeah. It's and huge. So that's, you know, that's where I choose to put energy. And I think I also choose to put energy in just continuing to weave the net of my family around my children, my community and my family around my children.
Can you talk a bit about your kids and what they give you?
What they give me.
Mm.
You know, I think that most parents can relate to just like the joy and also the exhaustion. I mean, it's not, we all relate to this, but there's a quality of like joy and wholeness, I think, that can come with having children as just part of the human experience. And so there's that baseline that we all have. And I feel, again, lucky that for me, having kids, and I really enjoy being a mom. I know that's not true for everybody, and I don't have any judgment about that. I think I consider that also a form of good fortune, that it's something that I enjoy so much, because it is fairly all-encompassing, even without cancer, right? It's a big thing, having children, and you it's good to enjoy it. That's because it's your life when you cross that threshold. But I think in terms of the experience with cancer, I feel like we talked about this the last time we were together, I think. I think that having children, mine are now 10 and 7, it provides a quality of focus and purpose that is in undisputed, right? Like, you know, your whole identity gets stripped away as part of this disease in a way. I can't really have the kind of professional life I had before. There's so many things that I can't do, but my role as a mother will never end. And so I think that quality of just, that piece of the identity piece, like there is a reason for me to be here, that's so clear. Not that I wouldn't necessarily feel that otherwise, but it's just like, I don't even know how to describe the energy behind that. It feels deeply nourishing while facing the challenges of metastatic cancer. Also, children are just who they are. Like, they don't give a shit if you feel bad. They're like, you need to show up and look at me and help me out right now. Like, or I'm gonna give you a really hard time right now. Or, I mean, I remember, you know, they demand your attention. Mm-hmm. They demand it. So this can be very hard. Like, if you can think of your own days, like, yeah, you can imagine that there's days when you're like, I'm so tired, and you can just be in those moments like, whew, thank God it's just me here, yeah, right? So it's very challenging to parent through, you know, physically challenging days. I mean, it's hard. And anybody there's a host of people with other chronic illnesses that could relate to that. Mm. When you just are fatigued, or you're not, your belly feels crappy, or you're irritable, or you've had a horrible night's sleep, or your heart's racing, or whatever. Yeah. It's hard to just show up and be loving and present with your children.
Yeah.
But it's also, the challenge of it is very, I think it's extremely healthy for me and nourishing. They give so much back, even with all that they're demanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like they give you wholeness.
I think maybe, yeah. It's a really, yeah, I never thought about it that way, but I think it's true. I think that's true. I think if I didn't have a family, and I feel a little bit of tenderness saying this, even with you, because you don't have children. And so I feel like I'm going to have tears in my eyes now. I feel this quality of like, I got really lucky. And with breast cancer even, like, I had my babies. Like, so many women get diagnosed younger, and their fertilities, you know, those options are taken away from them. And so I feel a quality of tenderness or I don't know. It feels, I'm just aware that not everybody gets to benefit from that quality of wholeness.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a, and it might not be true for all women, right? For some women, it might just be like, this is too much. For me, it's definitely,
you can't imagine
it just
anything
makes
else.
So much sense. It all just makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
Our life makes sense. And it doesn't even feel, it's like I think about that crossroads, right? Like January 2017, you know, Trump got elected. I was in deep consideration, like so many of us, I think, about what my life was, what I should do. Hmm. Should I run for office? Should I go back to graduate school? Should I and get a degree in public policy? And like, what should I do to like meet in this moment? And
looking for meaning in that moment.
Yeah. And how do I respond to this like greater emergency that's happening around me? And then to be like quickly thrust into a family emergency, basically, where that all of those questions were just erased from the landscape of anything that I was considering.
Yeah. Not that they weren't important.
Yeah. You know,
that's a thing that strikes me. It's like, those were all important things, but just the immediacy of what you had to deal with in that moment, like, changed everything.
The road that my family and I ended up traveling, and again, we're lucky. This is not true for everybody. Cancer for some families just takes everybody down. Was we all got stronger as a result. You know, all of us got stronger, and I feel like our love has just grown and grown and grown. And my love and my intimate relationship with the kids is stronger. And it's just all gotten stronger. So, and they of course have been such an integral part of that. And the people around us who've been in with them and us and all of it, it's just all gotten more potent, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I'm so grateful for these two little monkeys. Oh my goodness. I'm so grateful for them. I mean, you know, it's the most vulnerable part. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I would not wish it on you. I'm glad that you don't have to think about what it would feel like to leave your kids behind.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for the immediacy and the fact that they're going to, you know, I'm going to pick them up in 3 hours. They're going to come home. We're going to try to make challah.
In this kitchen,
which I've never done. We'll see how it goes. We're going to try to make challah. And then they're going to beg me to watch a family movie. And we will probably all like curl up in bed, my husband and the kids and me, and like eat some popcorn and watch a family movie. And our hearts will be full. And, you know, if they weren't around, I'd probably be freaked out thinking about dying all the time.
I love that.
So bless them.
I love that. Well, on that note, so everyone who comes on the podcast, I'm inviting to share a bit about your own death fantasy.
What a great question.
What it is that you maybe imagine around, you know, your experience of dying, whether it's sensory, whether it's your preferences.
Right.
On what you would like or not like, if there's anything that jumps out at you that you've thought about.
Yeah. Oh my God. Such a good question. Wow, Emily. I'm liking, and I love that I'm not afraid to answer it. I think about it both physically and metaphysically. Mm-hmm. You know, with my body, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, people can't see me here, but you know me. Like, I have a pretty strong, sturdy body. And I had this experience recently of doing some of psilocybin, which is one of these medicines that, you know, can be very beneficial for cancer folks. And it's very something I was really interested in trying. And it was very interesting to me that, you know, the story of it, and Michael Pollan did the whole book about it, and they had all this research at NYU for a while, tons of stuff. But this whole thing of, like, you get into the space, your identity strips away, and then you have this feeling of kind of peace with what might happen. So here's what my experience was.
All right, this is going in an interesting direction.
So part of my experience was like, okay, my ego structure is not laying down easily. Like, whatever this body is not going quietly. We had to give me so many mushrooms.
Oh my God.
At a certain point, it was like, it was kind of a warm up, you know, so maybe later, but now we know you got to give me a lot. It was a warm up. So it was all good. We were kind of experimenting, but it was clear that like my ego structure, and I don't mean that as like my my public puff face ego person boast that, not that, but just my ego, how I integrate in myself is very strong. So what that leads me to believe about a possible, I'm just not sure like how easily it's going to happen for me to like leave my body and really let go of all of that. Like and especially when you're tethered by children, you know, your own biological children, right? That to me is a mammal thing. Mm. So who the hell knows what it's going to actually take for me to die physically. I have a lot of cancer on my liver. I can't live without my liver. and, you know, maybe there'll be some miracle in the next couple of years and I'll get through it, or maybe I'll go into liver failure and at some point I will die. I mean, I'll die either way, either now or in the future. But that physical part is very curious to me. Like, will it just be, because I've never been easy. That's never been easy for me to sort of, it's easy for me to let go creatively. Like, we're going to dance and do my improv, or I'm going to do my automatic writing, or like, woohoo. Yeah. But to like let go of all of me. I've never been into recreational drugs. It's just not my thing. So that part I'm curious about. But I do have this idea that once you've died, it's kind of a big adventure. I hope I'm right. I mean, who knows, right? Yeah. But I have this idea that everything that we cannot see becomes revealed. Because we have this idea, I was talking about this with my kids the other night. Here we are on planet Earth. You look out at the galaxy. I mean, there's no way this is all that's happening. There's just no way. That makes no sense at all. So I do believe that even now there's other dimensions working inside on planet. Like, there's things happening. There's things happening. So my curiosity, I'd be very excited to have some of that curiosity quenched. And I do have this idea also that I think I've just heard it enough times, you know, that feeling of like, it kind of all becomes about love, or how we define love.
You mean at the moment of leaving whatever this life is?
Let me rephrase. I think theologically, my idea about death is actually that you're going home. I think that's how I would put it theologically. Like, that it is really a return to home when you die. That this is like the hero's journey we're on right now. We're on the hero's journey here in this embodied reality, and that dying is going home. I think that's how I think about it from a theological perspective.
It's a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you for joining us, Lita.
Thank you, Emily, for all your fun questions. And
I love you.
Yeah, I love you too.
There really is a skill, maybe an art, to navigating our lives. When things come up, it is so easy to get caught up in negative emotions and to follow life's unhelpful distractions into difficult and dark places. As we go through life, there will be happiness, and there will be suffering, and everything in between. But in the moment when we feel fear or grief, it is really hard to find a place of acceptance. When I feel overwhelmed, what I try to do in those moments is to bring my focus to the thought of becoming the very best me that I can be. To tune into my goals and my dreams. I think about seeking deeper connections with loved ones and about enjoying the beauty of the world around me. This practice doesn't always keep me from losing myself in those moments, but it helps me to stay calm. Because the fact that I can both feel my sadness and feel hopeful about my future self shows me that my perspective can change, is changing. And really, that's what every moment is, change. The poet Rumi has written a lot about change. He said, "Your hand opens and closes, opens and closes. If it were always a fist or always stretched open, you would be paralyzed. Your deepest presence is in every small contracting and expanding, the two as beautifully balanced and coordinated as bird's wings." In this next segment, we are going to hear from someone very special to me. Her name is Jasmine Charles. This clip is taken from an upcoming episode that is all about grief. Right after our friend Emily Garnett died from breast cancer last year, I interviewed Jasmine and a few other women from our support group. It felt important to me to capture these voices. At the time, we were all struggling and hurting from this loss. Just talking about it now, I feel a tightness in my throat. But I knew I wanted to learn about grief. There's a great book from the late 1970s called The Craft of Dying by Lynn Laughlin. It was a new idea to me that this could be a craft or a skill that could be improved. So I leaned into learning about grief and approaching it as a skill. All right, as I cue up this next segment, we have Jasmine talking about our friend Emily, and I love what she says about how she became more accepting. A few months earlier, Jasmine had gone through a period of uncertainty about her prognosis. Her doctor spelled out some best and worst case scenarios for what might happen, and Jasmine's reaction to that just blew me away. As always, this part of the episode features someone who has died. Jasmine died about 6 weeks after we spoke in May 2020.
I can't be upset if anything should happen to me because I'm like, look at the time you've been granted, you know? So it's this feelings, like just dealing with that.
Do you find that changes over time, that the different feelings you have surrounding grief for a specific person?
A lot of feelings around grief has come up like now. In the past, it was really, you know, you're saying your prayers, you're getting new medicine, you're going into these scanners, and you're just like, please, no more tumors. Please let this be the healing cocktail. Please let this happen. And at this point, because so many of us, like just in the past couple of months, are just leaving this earth, it's just like, I'm more accepting of it. Before, I was really scared, but now I'm just more accepting of it. And that grief and that fear has just turned, it coupled together and just turned into just celebrate each day and see how much of myself I can leave behind in a positive way for not just my kids, but just everybody around me. And that makes every day a little bit better. Yeah,
I hear you. How did you get to that place of acceptance?
I think from December, because in December, once my liver swelled up and my stomach was just at its like biggest, my oncologist at that time said, usually, worst case scenario, you're given 3 weeks with a liver that big. But I mean, that's just worst case scenario if the medicine won't take it down. And from that point on, I said, you know what? That's the worst case scenario. And if it now, what if I did have 3 weeks? What am I going to do with it? How am I going to make it purposeful? I don't want 3 weeks, but how do you make it purposeful? And I don't want it to be like, I have 3 weeks. Let me see what I can do with it. But just live every day like you've been told you have 3 weeks. But still enjoy it, you know. And before, not like in a time frame, like get this done, get this done. But just sit back and enjoy it. And once everything started spiraling with this COVID-19 and everything, and you just seen the numbers and numbers of deaths around you, it's just like, at one point I was given 3 weeks, and now we have thousands and thousands of people who had no idea and who have gone. I can't be mad and I can't be upset. You know, like it just seems unfair. So you just deal with, just bear the cross that I have to carry, you know, that's it.
Talking about grief as a topic, how do you process, or what have you learned maybe over time as fellow people living with metastatic breast cancer? We have this repeated trauma of losing our friends and seeing our friends sick and maybe recover, maybe not. And I find that very difficult to just have to keep facing it. I'm guessing you do too. Are there certain ways that you have learned to think about it or channel your energy or process how to get through this?
I think it beats me down even lower with each person, that because whenever you see the group, you're just like, at one point I was sitting at the table with about 15 people. And of those 15 people, about 5 of them are gone already. And it beats you down. Like, you want to come back up and you want to say they're no longer suffering. But we fight so hard and we battle so hard for, sometimes it's just a hard end, you know? It's not a smooth end, and it's not a time. Like, you almost want to negotiate a time promise. That's the hardest part, is getting back up. And it just seems like when we're losing someone, someone else is coming into the circle for more strength. And even if we're together for just that period of time, I appreciate it. Appreciate the fact that we're able to help each other, whether it's from a couple months, a couple years, a couple weeks.
Well, that's it for this episode. I've posted the show notes on my website, 10thwind.com, where you can also sign up for my newsletter and send me feedback. I would love to hear from you. If you are signed up for my newsletter, you know that Happy Death is now available on your favorite podcast app. That is, if your favorite app is Google or Apple. Go ahead and subscribe if that's what floats your boat. Until next time. Happy Death is a 10th Wind production. For helping to make this project a reality, I would like to say thank you to the lovely Lita Diederich, Rainy Audio Ortega, Jasmine Jazzy Stinky Boo Boo Charles, Kelsey Moneybags Weaver, and my dear mom and dad. From Macanda, Illinois, I'm Emily Veach.